This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Discover how to lead a better life in our age of confusion. Enjoy this BBC audiobook collection, written and presented by best-selling author Oliver Berkman, containing four useful guides to tackling some central ills of modernity: busyness, anger, the insistence on positivity, and the decline of nuance.
Our lives today can feel like miniature versions of this relentless churn of activity. We find we're rushing around more crazily than ever. Somewhere, when we weren't looking, it's like busyness became a way of life.
Start listening to Oliver Berkman, Epidemics of Modern Life, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor'ı dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumya Ektay, The Fifth Floor, Farnak Amidi Sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. You might wonder how journalists find their stories. The truth is that a good story could come from anywhere, even from a casual chat with friends. And that is precisely how my colleague Eunice Yang from BBC Chinese started looking into the story that we are going to talk about today. Because she noticed that when someone announces they are pregnant, the common reaction from her Gen Z friends is,
"Why? Like, it's just 100%. Pure shock, pure astonishment. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you taking this risk?"
This might be a bit of a joke among young people, but it reflects a general trend in society. Birth rates in China have been falling for years. So much so that hundreds of maternity wards across the country are actually closing down. To understand what is going on, we have to go back to approximately 40 years ago, when the government introduced a controversial method of controlling its population. Here is Eunice again.
In the 1980s, China introduced the one-child policy as a reaction to the booming birth rate, because the country just cannot support so many babies. Every family, there has to be only one baby documented. So they're having a lot of cruel birth control methods. It also resulted in a lot of human trafficking, kidnapping. And however, it was abolished in 2015 because of the free-falling birth rate. One-child policy just became the history.
So it was lifted in 2015. And then what happened? What happened to the birth rate after that?
After that, there came the booming, as the experts always expected. We were talking about 20 million new births every year. 2 years after that, 2017, China received over 20 million new babies.
When they abolished this one-child policy, basically, and there was an increase in the birth rate, there was a lot of investment in maternity wards. Can you explain what was happening?
In 2016 and 2017, a lot of companies, they entered this market with huge confidence. They opened hundreds of hospitals nationwide. However, in 2021, there were only 10 million newborn babies coming to China. And in 2023, there were only 9 million. So it was a winter for the whole industry.
And do we know why we are witnessing this fall? What's happened?
The very crucial factor behind this is the economy. China has been facing a really bad economy in recent years, even before the pandemic. People are not getting so many money from the factory. They're losing their job. For this year, as far as I know right now, there are 4,000 people rushing to compete for one position in a tech company. So people are not even getting jobs, people are not getting paid or half paid or really low paid at this environment. How can they have babies? And it's quite controversial to get married nowadays. There's a joke among the Gen Z, say, if you're pregnant, we don't say congratulations. We say like, why? It's just 100%. Pure shock, pure astonishment. Like, why are you doing this? Why are you taking this risk?
In 2015, when the birth rate started increasing after the lift of the one-child policy, there were a lot of new maternity wards built and new facilities were built in China. Now that we are facing this decrease, what is happening to these wards?
this ward had to be closed. There were over 400 new hospitals were freshly opened in China during those years. All of them shut down in recent years. In 2014, one of the dominant company went on to the Hong Kong exchange market. It was listed. It exited the whole market permanently after 2020. Because the whole market is bad and these investors cannot get any money from it. And all of those investors, according to the doctors, they said all of the investors, they do not want to invest in this industry anymore. And for probably 10 years from now, they would not come back to this market again.
This is both public and private hospitals.
Yes. Even for some public hospitals, take a budget directly from the government. However, they do not wish to give the budget to the maternity ward anymore. Sometimes some hospitals told me that once they shut down this maternity ward, they can save up to 4 million yuan per year. In the rural area, some hospitals, they are only having 45 women coming to the hospital to have a baby annually.
So that's even less than one a week.
Yes. Some of the doctors I have talked to, they told me that to maintain a ward, they have to have over a dozen nurses and doctors waiting in the hospital because you don't know when your clients are going to come because baby might come at any time. And also for those public hospitals, the salary of the doctors, less than 20% of their salary come from the fixated salary. It's a fixated amount. And about 80% comes from the client volume, which means that there are not women coming here. They're not doing any checks. They don't get money. So they can barely support their family. They cannot be the breadwinner. One of the doctors I have talked to, they said, all of the people working in the maternity ward are not the breadwinners of their family. The doctor said they are just, they're sad and they're really nervous, anxious about their own future because they cannot see a future in the maternity ward anymore. They have been in this industry for their whole life. They only know how to deliver a baby. Those doctors, even though are famous ones, they have to consider change a job. Even just going back to school to teach the new students, the students would not go to the maternity ward anymore. And some of the hospitals, because they don't have any new students, like fresh blood entering the hospital to join the maternity ward, they have to force the new graduate, fresh graduate, to stay in the maternity ward for 3 months just to make sure we have enough people here. I have talked to several students from multiple medical school in China, and all of them confirmed this one fact to me that one class probably are going to be 200 or 100 students graduate from the same school. Mm-hmm. Only one want to become a doctor in the maternity ward. And that one people is not going to the hospital, it's not going to the ward, it's only to do the lab.
So Eunice, with all these facilities closing down, do women who are pregnant in China at the moment have access to the services they need?
Yes, they have access to what they need. And even compared to previous years, they have to queue up the whole night for one bed in the hospital. They no longer need to queue up there. They just go there. And for example, the antenatal care is going to be super smooth because you're the only one. They're serving there. So they're happy. At least they're happy.
Thank you, Eunice. That was Eunice Yang from BBC Chinese. I love tattoos and have been to different tattoo parlors all over the world, from New York to London and from Brighton to Madrid. For me, tattoos are like accessories and makeup, a way of self-expression. And I've built quite a close relationship with my tattoo artist who's been designing my tattoos for the past few years. And anyone who's ever had a tattoo or two would know that the relationship between tattoo artists and their clients is based on trust. You'll be wearing their work on your skin, after all. But what about tattoo artists in countries where it's banned or discouraged, like in South Korea, for example? Here, tattooing is considered a medical procedure, so it can only be done by someone with a medical license. And the tattoos themselves are very taboo. It's a law that's been there since the early 90s, but it's not massively enforced, so there are tattoo artists without a medical license who operate illegally. But operating in an illegal industry is difficult for artists and can leave them vulnerable in their jobs. Now, under a new generation, the industry is evolving. My next guest, Yuna Koo from BBC Korean Service, is based in Seoul and has been meeting the female artists in the heart of the capital's illegal tattoo scene. Yuna, welcome to The Fifth Floor.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you as always. So tell me, can we first talk about the impressions of tattoos in South Korea? How do people look at them?
I think nowadays there's a mixed opinion around tattoos. I believe tattoos are becoming increasingly popular, particularly small designs like stars, names, and flowers. People often get them as a way to express themselves, to commemorate something important. However, I would have to say that there is definitely some negative perception surrounding tattoos, particularly due to their association with some criminal activities. For example, when people see a photo of a criminal with tattoos, there are often comments like, I knew it. I knew he would have tattoos.
But tattoo parlors still exist in South Korea, don't they?
They do not just exist, but they are thriving, actually. As you mentioned, according to Korean law, tattooing is considered a medical procedure, which can only be done by medical doctors. However, not many doctors practice tattooing in South Korea. So according to a November report by the Ministry of Health and Welfare, they interviewed more than 1,600 people with tattoo. 81% of them said they received tattoo at tattoo parlors, while only 1.4% received tattoo at hospitals.
That's so interesting. When I was getting my last tattoo, the tattoo parlor that I go to in London, they usually have guest artists that come over, and they had guest artists from South Korea, and they were so popular. People were like queuing up to get tattoos by them. So it's very interesting. So tell me, how do these tattoo parlors have to alter their business to not get unwanted attention because they're not licensed?
It seems like the police and the authorities aren't trying to arrest those tattooists doing tattoo activity illegally. Instead, what many tattoo artists fear is their customers. When their client comes to their tattoo parlor and gets tattoo, after that, some of them makes complaint that saying that I think tattoo is done in a wrong way. I didn't want this kind of tattoo. I want to erase it. You have to pay me money so that I can erase it somewhere else. And many tattooists argue that there are these kind of people who are trying to rip off some money from tattooists using their precarious status as a illegal tattoo artist in South Korea. So what they're doing is to hide their location of the tattoo parlor. So that's done in a very secret manner. And they, when they go to the tattoo parlor, they do not have any signs on the building.
Have you ever been to any of these illegal tattoo parlors?
I don't have any tattoo on my body. Mm-hmm. But for this interview, I've visited two tattoo parlors, which is totally the opposite, I would say, because the first one is run by a tattoo union members. Mm-hmm. So there are many tattoo artists working in this studio. So they feel more protected compared to other tattoo artists who are running the business all by themselves. Mm-hmm. So they were putting a big signage on their building, and they were openly sharing their location on their Instagram as well. Mm-hmm. But another tattoo parlor that I visited, there was no sign on the building, so I didn't know the location. So I had to first meet the tattoo artist and then go with her to enter the tattoo parlor.
Despite all of this, people still choose to become tattoo artists for their career. And you met a couple of these tattoo artists. And one of them was a female tattoo artist called Yuzu. Tell me about her. How long has she been tattooing for?
So she's been tattooing for more than 10 years. Because tattooing has been illegal for over 30 years now in South Korea, and she's still doing it. She said the reason she's keep doing it is simply because it's so fun. She found it very satisfying because unlike other kind of artworks, the tattoo actually stays on the client's body forever.
For your report, you know, you spoke specifically to female tattoo artists. Why was that? Is it because the industry is mostly male dominated?
There are increasing number of women who are getting tattooed these days. Mm. And these tattoos done, tattoo designs made by female tattoo artists are very famous because it's really sophisticated and very feminine and very beautiful. And so it's getting increasingly popular. And another reason is because when I was talking to the head of tattoo union, he said there are around 700 tattooists enrolled in the union, and about 70% of their members are women.
Wow.
And I asked him, is it because the total number of women tattoo artists is higher than men? And what he said was female tattoo artists are more vulnerable to like sexual harassment or blackmailing by the customers. That is the reason why I focused on female tattoo artists in South Korea.
So do you think that there are going to be changes to this law? Maybe some reforms?
I'm very positive, as well as many tattooists are, because Japan, which is a neighboring country of South Korea with very similar conservative views on tattoos, legalized non-medical tattooing in 2020. So this could set up a legal precedent that could influence future verdicts in South Korea as well. And also in recent years, South Korean courts have acquitted non-medical professionals for tattooing in several cases, which means the South Korean courts is shifting its legal attitude somehow. In the past few months, both the opposition party and the ruling party in the National Assembly presented the bill, which aims to legalize tattoos and regulate hygienic standards and scope of work for tattooists.
Thank you so much, Yuna. Yuna Ku from BBC Korean. This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Discover how to lead a better life in our age of confusion. Enjoy this BBC audiobook collection, written and presented by best-selling author Oliver Berkman, containing four useful guides to tackling some central ills of modernity: busyness, anger, the insistence on positivity, and the decline of nuance.
Our lives today can feel like miniature versions of this relentless churn of activity. We find we're rushing around more crazily than ever. Somewhere, when we weren't looking, it's like busyness became a way of life.
Start listening to Oliver Berkman, Epidemics of Modern Life, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.
Ghana's traditional, colorful, woven textile, kente, has been officially added to UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage. This list recognizes cultural traditions at risk, stressing the importance of their protection and preservation. Kente isn't alone on the list. Jalilat Olawale from BBC Africa has been exploring some of the other African treasures on the list, and she joins me in the studio to tell us more. Hi, Jalilat. Lovely to have you on the Fifth Floor.
Hi, lovely to be here.
So can you explain what intangible cultural heritage is?
Intangible cultural heritage is a term used by the UNESCO to, you know, describe the practices, knowledge and expression that communities recognize as part of their cultural identity. Mm. It could be oral traditions, it could be performing arts, it could be social practices, rituals and festive event. Could be knowledge about nature and the universe,
mm-hmm.
and traditional craft, just like kente, and contemporary rural and urban practices.
And also food.
Yes, and food. So it is considered non-physical intellectual wealth. It's like historic places, monuments and artifacts. Those are physical. So these are non-physical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do African countries make up a large proportion of this list?
You could say that. So for this year, because this list comes out annually, mm-hmm. for this year there are over 60 items on the list. About 30 of them are from Africa. Yes.
Is that a source of pride?
I mean, a lot of Africans believe that a lot of these things ought to be protected, you know, and cherished, because we have erosion of a culture and you want the generation next to come to see what you have. And if they are well protected, then, you know, it's a thing of pride. For Kente, when we published that, a lot of comments on that were like, oh, this is long overdue. It should have been done a long time ago.
And they've survived colonialism and everything. They're so deep rooted within the society.
Absolutely. And they have meaning, you know. Mm. It's not just a piece of fabric. It's something that has meaning to the people, you know. Someone said, the Kente cloth embodies royalty. It is one that should be incorporated into the royal fabrics of all royalty around the world. That shows you they are proud of it.
And Julilat, tell me about Kente itself.
Oh, Kente. Kente is so beautiful.
It is, actually.
really colorful. And it comes in different colors, you know, red, orange, blue.
Vibrant
color. They are usually woven from silk, cotton, and rayon. The maker usually weave it from the start. So they put all these fabrics together and it becomes a whole.
And it's all hand woven?
Yes, hand woven. It's passed down from generation to generation. It is also believed that finished products are named with proverbs, sayings, and social situation. So it could be you have a popular saying and you want yours to represent this. Like I said, it's not just fabric.
There's a story behind
it. It's so deep. I think the purple one will look really good on you. I have this purple background with touch of blue.
Well, I count on you to bring me some.
I know, right?
Do you see younger generation producing and making and weaving Kente?
Absolutely. You could actually see that this fabric is being mixed with other modern fabric these days. I've seen it on the runway. You could see a touch of that. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the entire thing. You could see people used to make tile. People used to make scarf. So that's just to show you that it does not matter where you are, whether in Ghana or you're in the UK or you're in the US, you will find Kente.
So being enlisted on this heritage list just makes sure that it is established where the roots of this textile are.
It belongs to these people.
Mm-hmm.
It belongs to them.
That's a good
not
point.
The other way around.
So one of the other intangible cultural heritage on the list is the Durbar Festival, which takes place in Kano, Nigeria. Tell us about it. What happens there?
It's usually a procession of about 10,000 men on horses, and you have other men and women on foot cheering them on. It's usually very gallant and a bit chaotic, of course, because you have horses riding and all of that, but it's quite beautiful. It usually takes place like during the night and 12th month of the Muslim calendar, which is to mark Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Kabir.
So end of the Ramadan.
Yes, and end of the Ramadan, then Eid al-Fitr.
So is it a religious festival?
In that part of the country, the people who live there are not only Muslims, right? But I think it's more of a cultural thing. I think, or I like to believe, that time is chosen because when you have big festival, people who are not residing but are from that particular community will come back home. You know, it's like Christmas when people will have to like travel far and wide
to get home
to go see family. And you have these people, you have them in large numbers. So, and you look forward to it.
What do we know about the history and the background of this festival?
So this festivity dates back to a time when the Kano Emirates used horses in warfare. There are usually four processions. each serving a specific purpose and having its own timing and costumes. And during this period, each town, district and nobility household was expected to contribute a regiment to the defense of the emirate. So that explains the four procession. And once or twice a year, the emirate military chiefs would invite the various regiments for Durba, which is simply military parade.
You know, so it used to be a military parade.
Yes, to celebrate for the emir and his chief. Today, as we know, there are no more communal wars. but the tradition still goes on. And of course, we still have the emir. So you pay homage to the emir, and the emir will also, you know, acknowledge his subjects, in quote.
So there are certain cuisines which are on the list as well. And one of them is acheke.
Acheke. I've had it one or twice. It's from Ivory Coast. It's really nice.
What is it?
It's made from fermented cassava. You know couscous? So we call it a traditional couscous because it's like in that form, right? I didn't even know it was from, Ivory Coast. The first time I had it, I thought he was from Ghana, but...
You were wrong.
I was wrong. It's traditionally reserved for special occasions, like weddings and birthdays. But these days, people eat it anytime, any day, and it's gone way beyond Ivory Coast. You should try it. I think you'll love it.
Definitely. We've tried different stuff on the fifth floor. Next on the list is acheke. Thank you, Jelilat Olawale.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jelilat Olawale from BBC Africa. I'm Farinak Hamidi. The fifth floor team this week was
Alicia Joya
and
Caroline Ferguson
and
Hannah Dean.
You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
Discover how to lead a better life in our age of confusion. Enjoy this BBC audiobook collection, written and presented by best-selling author Oliver Berkman, containing four useful guides to tackling some central ills of modernity: busyness, anger, the insistence on positivity, and the decline of nuance.
Our lives today can feel like miniature versions of this relentless churn of activity. We find we're rushing around more crazily than ever. Somewhere, when we weren't looking, it's like busyness became a way of life.
Start listening to Oliver Berkman, Epidemics of Modern Life, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.